Redbeard here, today in the studio with a piano man, intent on smashing an image of being simply a balladeer.
Maybe wrong for all I know, but you made it right.
I think what I was doing with the Glass Houses record in the studio when it came time to get together with the band was becoming a garage band all over again. I wanted to have fun, and I wanted to make music that all the musicians enjoyed playing as if we were in a bar.
Sometimes a fantasy, oh, is all you need.
Now, I could have come out with a record that would have guaranteed a certain amount of sales just by repeating either the Stranger album or the 52nd Street album, like doing something similar. You know, a little bit different, but basically the same kind of music. And I would have been bored to have done that.
But it's too rock and roll to me.
Hi, this is Billy Joel in the studio for Glass Houses.
Billy Joel began studying classical piano at the tender age of only 4. But like millions of American kids, that all changed after seeing the Beatles perform on the Ed Sullivan TV show. Much to the dismay of his German-born father, Billy Joel chose to forsake his classical piano training in favor of rock and roll. His second album, 1973's Piano Man, broke into the top 30 and established a small but ardent cult following. But Billy Joel's fifth album, 1976's The Stranger, it became the biggest seller in Columbia Records history by retailing more than 10 million copies and copying a Grammy Award for Song of the Year with Just the Way You Are. The follow-up album, 52nd Street, also went to number one, selling almost as many and winning the Grammy for Album of the Year. Billy Joel was now big time, a superstar with a defined sound and image. But that rebellious nature that Billy had exhibited as a youngster, rejecting his father's desire for Billy to play classical piano, that was about to manifest itself on the March 1980 release, Glass Houses. I asked Billy Joel about the title of the album and that famous cover photo of a leather and denim-clad Billy about to hurl a rock through a giant glass-walled house.
Well, it goes back to the old cliche, people who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. Well, I had felt that I was getting pegged as a balladeer. I just wanted to shatter that whole image. So, and I lived, that's my house, that was my house.
Oh, really?
On the cover, yeah.
Oh.
And I was outside one day, I looked back at the house and I said, this is interesting, the reflection here with this big expanse of glass. And, you know, again, using the cliche, people who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones, I thought, why not? Why shouldn't they? And I wanted to, change up. I wanted to show somehow, forcefully, what I was going to do. And it just seemed like the perfect, metaphor. And also, I was taking quite a critical pasting by 52nd Street because of the commercial success that I'd have. You know, if you're too successful commercially, you're suspect. He must be doing it just for the money. And also, I became pegged as a balladeer because of songs like Honesty and She's Always a Woman and Just the Way You Are. And I didn't think that was a fair label.
Wasn't hurting
That particular riff of doom down bow do down bow down, I think that was between myself and a guy named Russell Javers, who was playing guitar at the time. We were all of us Rolling Stones fans. We grew up listening to Stones, and when we were in our first bands, playing Rolling Stones songs at parties, in nightclubs, and bars at Sweet 16s, and but you always had these Keith Richards, Brian Jones guitar lines. Dun, 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 dun. But under my thumb, or you had the last time.
Oh, that's a great You can listen to that all day, can't you?
Absolutely.
It's kind of circular.
That's it.
It can kind of go on forever.
That's right. They just, there's this magical jangly guitar thing that the Stones were so good at. So you may be right. Was in that same tradition of just jangling through the song. What I was doing with this first song, and almost with this whole album, was getting back to my bar band roots. I always liked playing the Stones, the Beatles, the Kinks, the Zombies. Those are the bar bands I came out. Those are the garage bands I started out in.
Right.
Question Mark and the Mysterians, yeah. Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs, all that junk rock, which was really good, fun stuff.
Great. It was great, fun stuff.
The English bands got really good at it. Now, I think what I was doing with the Glass Houses record in the studio when it came time to get together with the band was becoming a garage band all over again, which is why the album works so well. And, you know, there's this great similarity here to Stormfront, because it was the same premise. I wanted to have fun, and I wanted to make music that all the musicians enjoyed playing as if we were in a bar. Like, you could take the instruments, once you've learned the song, go to a bar somewhere, pick up another band's instruments and play this stuff and make it sound great.
Wow.
The whole thrust behind this song, You May Be Right, was like, that we could go to a bar and just play this stuff and knock people out.
Lena. Where did you come up with the name?
I just made up a name. Well, Lena. Okay, well, that sounds good. That sounds like a girl who can break your heart, like the police did with Roxanne. There are certain names that girls have that they sound like heartbreakers, and this Lena just sounded like somebody who'd break your heart. I remember thinking, what was it like when I was 16? I remember what was it like when I was 16 when a girl broke up with me, when she left, or when girl decided that she was going to go out with somebody else. I remember 16, it was the end of the world.
It was devastating.
Devastating. It was like life was over. Oh, that was it. I was going to throw myself.
And you were the loneliest man, young man in the world.
Tragedy. Deep, deep tragedy. Horrendous Wagnerian tragedy. Ooh. I mean, Siegfried, the whole nine yards. Romeo and Juliet, death gone, gloom, doom.
And they'll miss me when I'm gone.
That's it. That's right. And if I go blind, they'll, that kind of thing. And I was, thinking about this. What was that like? What was that horrendous, Hamlet tragedy of breaking up all about? Because I don't really think I'd ever done it before, said it before that strongly. I was aware that there had been a great deal of, I guess we'd call it Billy Joel saturation for close to 3 years. At that point, from 77, 78, 79, going into 80, you're talking about a lot of Billy Joel hits being on the radio. I became the established act, the act that you got to knock off. Now, the nature of pop music is that it consumes itself. You've got to knock off, the big guys for the next thing to happen. And I was the big guy. I was, the next dinosaur. Now, I could have come out with a record that would have guaranteed a certain amount of sales just by repeating either the Stranger album or the 52nd Street album, like doing something similar. A little bit different, but basically the same kind of music. And I would have been bored to have done that. I would have been a dead duck, I think, career-wise, had I decided to do that also, because people would have seen, okay, well, that's the limitations of Billy Joel. They would have seen the outside of the envelope. Okay, that's about as far as interest as we're going to get out of him. Now, I tend to think that an artist has to take chances. You have to be willing to discard an audience and pick up another one. Now, I'm not saying leave behind people who like the music that you do. I'm saying you have to be willing to challenge them. You have to be willing to say walk away from it and try something completely different. And if it works, great. If it doesn't work, at least you've challenged yourself. You've showed growth in one way or another. If it's not commercial growth, at least it's artistic growth.
All the waiters in your grand cafe leave their tables when you blink. Oh, every dog must have his every day. Every drunk must have his drink. Don't wait for answers, just take your chances. Don't ask me why. All your life you had to stand in line. Still you're standing on your feet. Oh, all your choices made you change your mind. Now your calendar's complete. Don't wait for answers, just take your chances. Don't ask. Say the human heart is only make-believe. I am only fighting fire with fire. You are still the victim of the accidents you lead. Sure as I'm a victim of desire. Yeah, yeah, you're all the servants in your new hotel. I can tell you're no stranger to the street. Don't ask for favors, don't talk to strangers. Don't ask me why.
chances. Don't ask me why. Don't ask me why.
Coming up, Billy gets into trouble from the phone company and for causing an international incident worthy of a Mel Brooks comedy. For this and your other favorite rock star interviews, visit InTheStudio.net, follow In The Studio on Facebook, and at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter. I'm Redbeard, with Billy Joel, in the studio for the anniversary of the number one album, Glass Houses.
Welcome back to In The Studio. I'm Billy Joel with Redbeard for Glass Houses.
Thanks, Billy. There's a song on the Glass Houses album called Sometimes a Fantasy that begins with touch tone dialing of a phone call. Here's Billy Joel with me in the studio.
We got in trouble for that number because people figured out whose number it was.
From the touch tones?
Yeah. And then...
So all over the country?
All over the country, kids were calling this number and harassing
whoever
this person was. So
they
were going to sue us. Oh. I said, well, wait a minute. This is a random number that we just picked here.
That's funny. You're always getting into hot water. And you don't try to, do you?
I'm not trying to. Yeah. I'm not looking for
it. Hey, not looking for a fight. Tell me about the singing in the verses of Sometimes a Fantasy. It's like almost a mock rockabilly hiccup type of thing.
Yeah, because the chords and the music accompaniment underneath was so spare, it lent itself to an Elvis, Jerry Lee Lewis type of reading of the lyric. Well, I didn't want to do, I got too lonely. The rhythm, because of the thump-punk-a-punk-a-punk-a-punk, you had a built-in phrasing almost of what the vocals were going to be. Well, I had to call you up in the middle. Also, the echo that I put on the vocal just lent me to want to sing like
when
that.
When you heard yourself just setting up the mic maybe in the studio, it just like you had
oh, yeah.
To, you had
I felt like
it.
I was in Memphis doing a Sun session.
There you go. There you go.
So sometimes a sound will make you perform a certain way, which is, you hope for that too, that it becomes obvious what you should do.
There's a song, You Were the One, on Glass Houses that inspired Billy Joel to sing more than half of the lyrics in French. Just one little problem, though.
I don't know how to speak French. This was all, I got this melody and I said, this sounds like a French song to me. It sounds like a chanson, which is a French song. No, 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 no. I don't know what got into my head. I said, I want to sing part of this song in French. The way McCartney sang Michelle in French, part of Michelle. Ma belle sont les mots qui vont très bien. So I thought, wow, that was so cool.
Yeah, but he did one verse. You did three quarters of a song.
Well, I'll tell you what I did. I hired a French instructor from the famous Alliance Française, where they speak, they teach French. It's like a Berlitz school in New York. This guy comes down with a little mustache, and I give him the lyrics to in American, in English. Here I am again, la da 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 da. And we give him a microphone. I said, now listen to the music and try to do the translation in rhythm. Translation.
The meter of
in the same meter as we're doing the song. This guy got all bent up. He thought I wanted him to sing in French. I don't sing, I don't sing. Me revoici. And he had no sense of phrasing. He had no sense of time. He had no sense of rhythm. I mean, this guy was horrendous as a singer, musician, a phraser. So I really couldn't get any idea out of what he was saying. I just tried to learn how to pronounce things properly. But I had no idea how to speak French. To this day, I still don't know how to speak French. I know how to order snails, and maybe a red wine or two. And that's about it.
Here I am again in this smoky place with my brandy eyes. I'm talking to myself. You were the one, you were the one. Here I go again, looking for your face, and I realize that I should look for someone else. But you were the one, you were the one. I'm looking for comfort that I can take from someone else, but after all, can save me from myself. You were the only one. Me revoici dans un bar fumé avec mes sourires. Je me parle à moi-même. Où c'était toi? Où c'était toi? Me revoici, je cherche ton visage. Je réalise que je devrais en chercher un autre. Où c'était toi? You were the one. Je recherche l'affection qu'un autre pourrait me donner. Mais après tout, je sais qu'il n'y a personne, personne qui puisse me sauver. Toi t'es la seule.
Now, I thought, because we were touring Europe at that time, and I said, boy, when we go back to France, this is going to be a monster in France. Wait till they hear this one. We do this song in front of the French audience. We toured the French provinces, Nice, Lyon, Saint-Étienne, Bordeaux, all these French provincial towns, and I'm singing this song. Me revoici. The audience is sitting there. Remember the film by Mel Brooks, The Producers?
The Producers.
After the audience hears Springtime for Hitler, they sit there with their mouths open. Well, that's what they did after this song.
Oh, no.
There was no response. It was as if I was singing in Polish. They didn't understand a word. What I had done in an attempt to be charming to the French was I butchered the mother tongue. And the song just died a miserable death. And
so maybe with doing it phonetically and rather than really knowing the language, you may have said like your mother smells like
combat
cheese.
Boots. There you go. I've committed some kind of sacrilege in France because you don't mess with their language.
No.
And so the song was dropped from my repertoire.
That's
and
a great...
as a matter of fact, people have asked me if there's any songs that you've wish you hadn't written. This is one of them. If there was a way I could take this one back, just like, the words come fly out of your mouth, and you wish you could put your hands in front of the words and kind of jam them back in. I would like to do it with this one. Now, I still like the melody.
It's a beautiful melody.
I think the chords are great, but lyrically, this one is a stinker.
That's pretty funny. Still to come, the laughter fades into personal turmoil and even a career-threatening motorcycle accident, even as the Glass Houses album passes the 7 million mark. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and for more Billy Joel interviews and exclusive live performances, visit inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're with Billy Joel in the studio.
Welcome back to In the Studio. I'm Billy Joel with Redbeard for Glass Houses.
As we were hearing your music all over the radio in that period, 77, 78, 79, what were you hearing in the clubs around New York City? What was going on?
Oh, that was the height of punk and new wave. 77 to 80 was Elvis Costello, Sex Pistols, Clash, Blondie, Television, a lot of stuff. The New York Dolls were out around then. Vital new music going on at that time, which was probably another reason for me changing the kind of music I was going to do. Obvious there was all kinds of new forces out there. There were all kinds of interesting, vital new music made by a whole other generation of people. I thought it was good. That kind of music, I wasn't a big fan of punk. I got the instinctive,
visceral.
Visceral, I'm sorry. The writer in me, right?
No, it's okay, it's early. Hey,
visceral.
You did a gig last night.
Reason for its existence, which was really to give the music industry an enema. Because you had these overblown bands like Emerson, Lake and Palmer, and Yes, you just had a lot of bloated dinosaurs hanging around, and punk was really wanted to bring rock back to its roots, which is the reason I wrote Still Rock and Roll to Me, actually, which is the next phase, new wave, dance grid, you can call it what you, post-punk, new wave, I don't care what you call it, I recognize it as rock and roll.
What's the matter with the clothes I'm wearing? Can't you tell that your tie's too wide? Maybe I should buy some old tab collars. Welcome back to the age of jive. Where have you been hiding out lately, honey? You can't dress trashy till you spend a lot of money. Everybody's talking about the new sound. Funny, but it's still rock and roll to me. What's the matter with the car I'm driving? Can't you tell that it's out of style? Should I get a set of white wall tires? Are you gonna cruise the Miracle Mile? Nowadays you can't be too sentimental. Your best bet's true baby blue continental. Hot funk, cool punk, even if it's old junk, it's still rock and roll to me. A pair of pink sidewinders and a bright orange pair of pants.
Rummel, baby, if you just give it half a chance. Don't waste your money on a new set of speakers. You get more mileage from a cheap pair of sneakers. Next phase, new wave, dance great. Anyways, it's still rock and roll to me.
What I was doing in that song was putting down the press, and the press recognized that. It says it doesn't matter what they say in the papers, because it's always been the same old scene. In other words, kids will always discover their own music. There's a new band in town, but you can't get the sound from the story in a magazine. In other words, no matter how they try to explain it to you in writing, they can't. They're impotent when it comes to radio. Radio will tell you what it sounds like, because you'll hear it. Yeah. But to try to get it from what somebody writes, forget about it.
Right.
That's their own particular subjective analysis of what it is.
Totally.
You can't get the sound from a story in a magazine. The press recognizes this as a threat to their phony baloney jobs. They went after me with a hammer and tongs.
Yeah. Won't be the first fight you ever got in, right?
Uh-uh.
Were you a little annoyed, as I was, that some of these writers and chroniclers of that particular time were trying to pass off skinny ties, skinny lapels, and Farfisa organs as something new?
Yeah, that was another side of it that got under my skin, and I think I commented on it in that song also. You know, back to the future or forward to the past is really what we were doing.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, I remember this stuff. We used to wear this in the early 60s.
Sure did.
You know, I remember this stuff, so tell me what's so new about
it. Exactly.
It was another cycle. It was the beginning of another cycle, but there was really nothing revolutionary about it. It was rather reactionary, to tell you the truth.
It was. The attitude was fresh, though.
Yeah, it was younger people trying to get control of rock and roll again rather than the corporate powers that be, which I was all in favor of. It was one of the last things I remember I was writing the lyrics in the back of Liberty's Bronco on the way into the studio that day. We were driving from, I think it was Huntington or Oyster Bay or something, to Manhattan to go to A&R Studios. I went in Liberty's Bronco. The back of the thing was rotting out. And I was sitting there coming up. It's all rock and roll. It's just rock and roll. It's only rock. No, it's still rock and roll. Ah, there we go. Okay, fine. Boom, 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 boom. And writing lyrics. We're passing Left Rack City on the Long Island Expressway. I'll never forget that. And everybody was, you're going to have the lyrics because the session starts at 1 o'clock. You're going to have the lyrics. You're going to have the lyrics.
I noticed that the copyrights on all the songs were 79, and It's Still Rock and Roll to Me was 80. That like the last song you wrote for the session?
That was probably one of the last ones I wrote. I remember I picked that note out as a single finger composition. Dum, 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 dum. What you hear on the bass line is what I was playing on the right hand of the piano when I wrote it. And I realized a few years afterwards, is lay, lay across my big brass bed. So when you next time you listen to Still Rock and Roll to Me,
never heard
it. That's pretty obscure.
I never heard it. I'm going to have to listen to that again.
That's pretty. What's the man?
Wow.
Lay.
Oh, wow.
Lay across my big bed. I'm not saying I copied it, and I'm not saying that no one else has ever done an unoriginal chord progression, but I just, you know.
It's got to seep in there, though. I mean, all this music's out there in the cosmos, and it's in your head.
Yeah.
But unless you'd have tipped it, I never would have heard that.
And I don't, you know, Bob, Bob. I didn't mean to take this. It was done all in, and the melody's completely different, and the rhythm is different, so the intention is different. So
there you are getting into trouble again.
Here I go.
Billy Joel chose to chronicle the times with the song Close to the Borderline. With its memorable line about TV banality, I got remote control and a color TV. I don't change channels, so they must change me.
I remember when I first got remote control, which is right about that time. Well, okay, this is great. There's more channels. I don't have to get up and flip the channels. And really noticing, once you have the ease of changing those channels, there still ain't anything to watch. That the programming is so bad, I am becoming a victim of the banality of what's coming off that screen. I said, well, I'm changing the channels, but nothing's happening, but I'm still sitting here. So what the heck is happening to me?
Right.
I am becoming a potato, mentally and physically.
Right.
It was all sort of, I think, a response to urban insanity, which I've been seeing happen for quite a long time because I'm from New York. The aggravation factor that I used to be able to put up with, I no longer will put up with anymore. The beginnings of the urban decay and the nightmare that it was starting to happen in New York, I started writing in this song. The 44 caliber homicide was the Son of Sam murders, this guy Berkowitz. I was just shooting people at random. I thought that was a symptom of what was happening in the city, and it's continuing to this day. It's gotten worse. Close to the borderline, it's an old theme that I probably keep coming back. There's any message, or what, I keep asking you, what's your message? Or what, you know, what do you like to write about? It is, how does the average person, which I don't believe there is the average person, but how do people keep from absolutely going bonkers in the society we live in? How do you hold it together? How do you raise a family? How do you keep a job? How do you remain being a decent person with all these incredibly negative forces pulling at you all the time?
And they seem to be increasing.
They're increasing more and more. Drugs, crime, the pressures of technology.
Yeah, and just the population crunch in the big urban
right
areas. Just space.
That's it. The lack of
that's
space.
Very
pollution.
Freudian.
You know,
yeah,
the bombarding of Madison Avenue, the lack of quality in things. To be a decent human being and to not, you know, to not explode in a rage like they did in Network, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore, to me is a feat, is a true testimonial to human endurance. And that's what this song is. I'm getting close to the borderline. I'm getting close. You know, if I get pushed a little further, I'm going to go over the edge.
Billy Joel's Close to the Borderline from March 1980's Glass Houses album. The album spent 6 weeks at number one, sold over 7 million copies initially, and was ranked the number four seller for the entire year of 1980, scoring another Grammy Award, this time for Best Male Rock Vocalist. But all of that was threatened by a frightening event that almost stole everything from Billy Joel.
Pretty simple. I was on a motorcycle, Cafe Sportster, was it the XLCR Harley Davidson, which is a, they only made a few of them. Cafe racer style Harley with short handlebars, which is why the hands got broken, because they're called shorty bars. I was going through an intersection. I had the perfect right to go through an intersection. I had the green light. A woman in a car from the side street who had the red light ran the red light. She just went right through the light. There she was in the middle of the intersection. My motorcycle hit her car. The only thing I could do at the time, I couldn't go into the right lane because there was traffic next to me. I couldn't go into the left lane because there was traffic coming towards me. So there I was boxed in. I hit the brakes as hard as I could. But I was going at a pretty good clip. And the bike hit her car, and I flipped over her car. I had a helmet on, fortunately. Listen, Gary Busey, wear the helmet. I had a full face helmet on. I had boots on, I had gloves, I had leathers, so I was dressed to be as safe as you can.
Yeah.
I flipped over, I landed on my back.
Oh.
I was stunned for a few seconds, and I got up, and my first thought was, oh, the bike! My scoot, man! Oh, man, how's the bike? I went over, the whole front end of the bike was just total, and I was crushed because I loved that bike. And I just started to try to pull the bike out of the intersection over to the curb. And I looked and I realized that my hands had swollen to the size of grapefruits. My right wrist was just a gigantic, swollen, hideous thing. And my left thumb was mangled. And I said, oh, I think I better sit down. And I pulled the gloves off. And I saw that my hands were pretty well damaged. That was it, though. I mean, had I not been wearing the helmet, I might have been killed. You know what? It never crossed my mind that I wouldn't be able to play again, even if there was some loss of versatility, some loss of movement.
How long were you in the hospital?
I was in the hospital 2 weeks.
Surgery?
Yeah, I had major surgery on the wrist. They put a pin through my wrist. That was kind of strange. It looked like Frankenstein in the right hand.
Things coming out either side?
Yeah, yeah, a pin that I could kind of twist around. It was okay. Made people sick. And then my left thumb was in a cast also. I never forget when I was in the hospital. I'm lying in bed, and across from my window was a nurse's building, the nurse's dorm, the candy stripers. And they unrolled this huge sheet out the window, "We love you, Billy."
Oh.
And the nurses kept kind of waving and like flirting through the windows. And I said, hey, if you got to be in a hospital, this ain't bad. This is pretty cool. You know, there's the candy stripers sort of flirting out the window. So it made the hospital stay really quite pleasant.
That's good. Within months of that, we find out that you're getting a divorce.
Well, we had been separated all during the time I had the accident. All during the time I was making the nylon curtain, we were separated.
But we didn't know that.
No, because rather than, I wasn't doing interviews at the time, and I really wasn't talking about what was going on. Hopefully, so there would be some chance of patching the thing up. But it was pretty much dead in the water. And after the accident, it made me see things a lot more clearly in terms of what should be done.
Things
present themselves to you after you've been in a life-threatening situation a lot more clearly. People say there is a reason for everything happening, and I think there is. I think you can take something positive out of everything negative. Yeah, the marriage ended. It was fairly difficult to disentangle because she was tied up with management. Although she wasn't managing me at the time. It had been about 2 years since she actually managed me. But there were buyouts, and there were lawyers, and there were all kinds of things going on. And it was traumatic.
But the accident was, or could have served as a bit of a catharsis or a trigger
Absolutely. The accident made things very, very clear what was going to work in my life and what was not going to work in my life. And I mean, there are things obviously I'm not going to talk about, but while I was in the hospital, there was an incident that happened that made it very, very clear to me that this marriage is over. And that was the good thing that happened with that accident. Had I tried to continue to hold it together, that would have been a terrible waste. It would have been a disaster.
I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio. Thank you, my guest, Billy Joel. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2015, all rights reserved. Transcription, Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter, @RedbeardRocks, and online at inthestudio.net.